Ladies and gentlemen, the Speaker of the House, Ohio Republican John Boehner. Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And Happy New Year, Ron Elving. I'm Ken Reardon.
And Happy New Year to you too, Garth. I think we should start right out with this absolutely amazing, fabulous new Congress we have.
I think it's the first time, first of all, a lot of history was in the making. First time we have a speaker of color, a person of color.
That's
which
right.
Is kind of remarkable.
Orange.
Orange. That's exactly right. You know something? We make fun of all these things. I don't think people think it's funny, but we attempt to make fun. But there's something fascinating about watching this transformation of John Boehner, who was dismissed from the leadership in 98, who presided over the Republican Party.
Gingrich. He essentially fell with Gingrich, and when Tom DeLay rose.
He actually fell before Gingrich. He was pushed out of the leadership.
That's right. He was pushed out in the same sort of turmoil by which Tom DeLay emerged as the central figure. He didn't become speaker, partly because he didn't want to become speaker.
He had enough power. He had enough power.
Dennis Hastert as his stand-in. Right. And Hastert wound up being speaker longer.
But even in 2008, when he was minority leader, he also presided over a Republican Party that lost 20 additional seats in the House.
He was associated with the downfall of the Gingrich regime, of his own career, then the downfall of the House
Republican majority.
And they had lost so many seats while he was at the top. I think a lot of us thought that he was barely holding on with stronger new people like Eric Cantor coming up behind him, Mike Pence, other people who were going to threaten him, going to take his power away. And then they had such a fantastic year in 2010, and they picked up 63 seats, an extraordinary historic monument of an election. How can you not then install him as speaker?
Yeah. Well, but also the fact that I think that he's not part of that factional battles that DeLay was part of, that Dick Armey was part of, that even Newt Gingrich was part of. And I think Republicans are saying to me that the one thing they learned is that at least these guys had the majority, lost it, and now realize what went wrong. In 94, for example, they were in the wilderness for 40 years. They didn't know Gingrich and Bob Walker and those guys, Vin Weber. They never were part of the majority before. Mm-hmm. They didn't really know how to do it.
On the other hand, they had a very specific agenda, the contract with America. Much of it was internal. A lot of it had to do with how the House ran itself, and a lot of it had to do with things that were ultimately mechanical, things like term limits, budget amendment that would prohibit any kind of deficit spending,
things of
that nature. And they ran through that in the House. They didn't get it all through the Senate, and they passed everything in the House that they wanted, with the exception of term limits, because that was a constitutional amendment. It needed a two-thirds majority. But they had a lot of success in the early days, their first 100 days, and they knew exactly what they wanted to go after. It was after that that they started to do things like battle with President Clinton over the budget and
close the government,
shut the government down, thinking that that would not be an unpopular move, and being, as it turned out, wrong on that score. So this new group wants to have learned from that group, but at the same time, most of their agenda consists of wanting to dismantle the last 2 years of Barack Obama's presidency.
Well, because that's what they campaigned on, and that's what the Tea Party folks who were so outraged at the overreaching of the Obama administration, this is exactly what the Tea Party has said. We are sending you to Washington to dismantle the Obama overreaches of the past couple of years. So I think Boehner has a very difficult, to say the least, task in front of him, because one, he has to satisfy his Tea Party masters, or at least the people who sent his Republican colleagues to Washington with him. At the same time, I don't think now that they control the House, they no longer want to be the party of no. It's easy to be the party of no when you're in the minority. I thought Newt Gingrich was far more effective as a minority member, able to throw bombs, but once he became the speaker and in the majority, it was a much tougher task for him.
Well, but in this case, the Tea Party driven or fueled or respecting new House majority has set out its issue one, its first goal, and that is to, of course, repeal JACOB, J-K-H-C-O-B, as we know it. That's the job-killing health care overhaul bill. And I call it that because every time they refer to it, they refer to it as the job-killing health care overhaul bill. Even in the title of the repeal bill, they call it the job-killing health care overhaul bill. So will they succeed in repealing the president's health care program?
Well, they will in the House. The votes are there in the House, and they were promised. Look, they promised from day one, we are going to repeal this bill, and that's the first vote that they're going to have.
And they're going to do it on January 12th. I mean, they're going to do it right away.
On Wednesday.
The very first Wednesday that follows the swearing-in day.
And then once you pass it in the House, it becomes law, right? Oh, wait.
There's a
Senate. And wait, there's an Obama veto.
But they could get two-thirds to override.
No.
Why do it then? Why make their very first legislative act a kind of gesture?
Because they promised they would. And I think that's part of it. They promised the Tea Party folks, we were sent to Washington to repeal this. Now, ultimately, they know it's going to pass in the House. They know it'll fail in the Senate. But I think it could be the beginning of some kind of discussion between the Republican House and the Democratic Senate to talk about what parts of the bill could be modified.
I think you're right. I think there is something actually substantive going on here. It's not just sending a signal to the Tea Party, although it is that. It's not just sending a kind of signal to the Senate or a gesture to the rest of the body politic and to the power structure of Washington. I think they are also trying to begin, in perhaps a rather extreme way, a kind of dialogue specifically on health care. And let's also not neglect the importance of symbols. I mean, for example, they talked a lot about the Constitution throughout the campaign. They talked in the Tea Party movement a lot about the Constitution. And one of the first things they're doing, in fact, on the first day after swearing-in day, is they're having a ceremonial reading of the entire Constitution on the floor of the House. We have a little tape.
I would love to hear that.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility.
We know there's a lot of history in the 112th Congress. For example, Barbara Mikulski becomes the longest-serving female senator in history. She eclipsed Margaret Chase Smith's record by being sworn in this year. But also, you know,
that was kind of a moving moment. A dry eye in the House.
I think that is pretty. I mean, we talk about John Dingell being the longest House member, Robert Byrd, the longest member of Congress in history.
And the funny thing is,
in 1994, Newt Gingrich, the visionary, changed Congress forever. He lasted 4 years as Speaker. Nancy Pelosi, the first female Speaker in history.
Changing the world.
4 years as Speaker. So for all these major seat changes, they don't last forever. And John Boehner knows that the voters could be very fickle. What happened in 2006 is completely different than what happened in 2010.
Do they believe that? Here's my question. If you look at the 87 Republican freshmen in the House and ask them, do you think it's going to be for you like it was for Newt Gingrich and his revolution in 1994? Well, as you say, it wasn't that the Republicans lost control of the House in just 4 years, but they really lost their way in less than 4 years. And in fact, there was a coup against Gingrich that did not succeed as soon as the summer of 1997.
Right.
So the palmy days of first takeover do not last very long. But if you ask those 87 Republican freshmen, do you think you're going to be different? I think you'd get 87. Absolutely.
I agree with you, but I think John Boehner is well aware of the ups and downs, the pitfalls of thinking that you could last forever. John Boehner is a perfect example of somebody who experienced the highs and the lows, and he's back with the highs again. I think he, perhaps more than any other Republican, knows that this could be very, very temporary.
One change we can count on for sure. The House and Senate are not going to relate to each other the same way. In the last Congress, the 111th, we had the House passing something like 400 bills that the Senate never took up.
And same party,
You had, through much of that time, 60 Democratic votes, more or less, you know, two independents.
In the Senate.
And you had a huge Democratic majority in the House. They passed health care. They passed cap and trade. They passed the financial regulation bill. They passed Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They passed all these things that were going to be a difficult fight in the Senate. The Senate actually picked up and did a remarkable amount of it. They may not have passed the health care bill in the form the House wanted or the president wanted, but they passed it. When they had to go to Christmas Eve with their 60 votes and then later on come back and do it on budget reconciliation and really bend the rules, they did it. They did a lot of it, and yet the House was still focused on the 400 bills. It didn't get done, and there was a sense of frustration. Now you have one party in the House, you have the other party in the Senate in reduced majority. What kind of relationship is that going to be?
Well, the irony here is to talk about all the people who were defeated in 2010, perhaps because they did so much. Remember going back to 1948 when President Truman attacked the Republican-controlled Congress. He called them the Do-Nothing Congress, and so many of the Republicans were defeated in 1948. Of course, the circumstances were different.
It was a bit of a misnomer, but it was a very effective bit of politics. And the Republicans did the politics of 2010 about as well as Harry Truman did them in 1948. Whether the characterization of the 111th Congress was fair or not, it was very effective, and it clearly resonated with many of the voters Who were the voters? The voters were a little different group of people, a smaller group of people, and a somewhat differently defined group of people than we saw in 2008. And we're going to get back to talking about the electorate of 2012 many times in this podcast.
Before we go into 2012, the last remaining business of the 111th to the 112th Congress.
Ring a bell. The last election of 2010.
Lisa Murkowski certified in Alaska.
That's remarkable. It
how
really
come?
Is.
How come?
It's remarkable to see Lisa Murkowski certified as a senator when you think of how many other people in the Senate are so much more certifiable. Hey, interesting job swap they're pulling at the White House, by the way. Rahm Emanuel left the White House chief of staff job last fall and is now well on his way. This is interesting because I feel like we've been talking about this for a long time and there was a lot of suggestion that maybe Rahm Emanuel had some problems getting elected mayor of Chicago.
Doesn't look like it.
Doesn't look like it. Even though they have cleared the field of candidates who are African-American down to basically one well-known African-American candidate, Carol Moseley Braun.
Right. Danny Davis, the congressman who was also African-American and who was also running for mayor, decided to drop out. Reverend Jesse Jackson held a symposium in Chicago, said, look, we've got to unite. When you think of it, when you remember when Harold Washington in 1983, who became the first black mayor of Chicago, he only won because the white vote was split. Jane Byrne and Richie Daley.
Now, of course, Richie Daley eventually got his shot at being mayor and was mayor longer than anyone in history, including his father.
Just for the record, last week he broke Richard J. Daley's record of 21 years and 8 months. He's now the longest serving mayor, and he broke his father's record.
Okay, so he's going to give up the mayoralty of Chicago after this long, long career, and it's apparently going to be taken by Rahm Emanuel, who's giving up the job of being chief of staff of the White House. But just for symmetry, apparently the White House chief of staff job is going to go to Richie Daley's brother.
Bill Daley, who was Bill Clinton's Secretary of Commerce. He was Al Gore's campaign chairman when he was elected president in 2000.
In fact, he was the guy who went to the mic late that fateful night in November when we were all trying to figure out who had been elected president and said, hey, you know, earlier when we conceded to George W. Bush,
oops,
we didn't mean it. We actually think we may have won and we want to stay in the race.
But more importantly and more currently about...
But more relevant, Ron.
Yes.
But something more meaningful, Ron.
But Bill Daley, the thing about Bill Daley is that, again, the White House has sent out signals even before the election that they need to be more centrist-minded, more cooperating with the Republicans-minded. This is not what the progressive wing of the Democratic Party wants to hear. Bill Daley, who fought for NAFTA, who was basically a centrist, who said that the Democratic Party needs to move to the center, this is not what progressives want to hear.
No, he is a businessman's Democrat. He is a no-nonsense Democrat. He is, if you will, an all-business Democrat. I think he will not be at all what the liberal wing of the party wants to hear. And if the White House was worried, I don't know that they were, if they were worried at all about some kind of a challenge to the president in the primaries of 2012, this would seem to signal that that worry has gone away. They don't see anybody out there to run against him, and not that it would be a successful campaign,
right,
but a nuisance campaign.
Right, exactly.
And that could be in and of itself a problem, as Pat Buchanan was a huge problem for George H.W. Bush in 1992 and in other cases. I mean, whether it was a Dennis Kucinich kind of candidate.
For the record, Dennis Kucinich said he would not challenge
which
him.
Which is interesting, okay, because Dennis Kucinich may be just about to be out of a job. Redistricting is very likely to wipe out his district in the Cleveland, Ohio, right, area, and he would have a perfect excuse, if you will, to say, well, fine, if I've been rubbed out by the establishment in Ohio, I've got time to run against President Obama and try to pull him back to the left.
Yeah, but I agree with you. I think the most likely person who's going to lose his seat is probably going to probably eliminate Boehner's district, and then Boehner will be out of Congress. I don't think that's ever happened before, has it? The Speaker of the
you
House.
You mean lose the Speaker of the House?
Well,
not because of redistricting.
No.
We have seen Speakers of the House diselected.
Well,
unelected.
Tom Foley.
Defeated.
Tom
for
Foley
the
and resigned. Jim Wright. But more White House shakeup news. Robert Gibbs, the press secretary, announced he is leaving, is resigning his post to become a consultant.
Yes. He's going to be an outside political consultant,
yeah,
strategist. He's going to give some speeches. He's going to work for the reelection of Barack Obama, but from outside the White House. This is a slight variation on what was expected last fall. I'm actually not sure whether we talked about it on the podcast at all, but we did say that it was widely expected that Gibbs would leave the podium, being the daily briefer, being the person who was in every meeting and then, in some sense or another, translating those meetings to the media. We expected that, but we expected him to stay in the White House, perhaps have more of an Axelrodian kind of role.
I kind of thought that he and Axelrod, of course, is leaving the administration to work on the campaign.
Full-time and from Chicago.
Gibbs was going to do that, too. But we're talking about the Obama campaign starting up. Where are the Republicans here?
This is interesting. We had a notion, I think, 6 months ago that because of some of the low moments the Obama administration was going through during that year, legislatively in the polls, what have you, that the Republican field was going to be quite large, quite full, and that it would get active right after.
Out of the box.
Right out of the box.
Right.
January 1st, if not sooner, maybe right after the November elections. To some degree, the enormous success of the Republicans, particularly in the House, but also in the gubernatorial elections and also in the Senate elections, a lot of the energy focused on that, and there wasn't that much of a sense of a need to get the presidential candidates up and running. Plus, we got a couple of other factors, I think, that are holding back many of the people who were interested in running for president in 2012. And on top of all of that, Obama, oddly enough, after the lame duck session in December and with this new Republican Congress, looks less vulnerable than he did 6 months ago.
That's absolutely true. But, you know, go back to 1991 when George H.W. Bush was invulnerable because of the Persian Gulf War, things like that. Democrats didn't come out of the box until the fall of 91, which was plenty enough time. I mean, so in other words, we keep thinking, why haven't they announced yet? Why aren't they already in Iowa, New Hampshire? Although many of them have been.
Well, they've been
Iowa,
visiting.
Yeah. I mean, Rick Santorum lives there just the way Chris Dodd lived in Iowa.
Yes. You're going to have to talk me into taking Rick Santorum seriously as a presidential candidate. If you can do that, I can talk you into Michelle Bachmann as a serious presidential candidate.
Well, I'm actually thinking, first of all, it was very interesting the way that the House Republicans dealt with or didn't deal with Michelle Bachmann when they were coming up with the new leaders in the Congress. Michelle Bachmann clearly wanted a role. She announced for a position that she didn't get. But when the leadership, Kevin McCarthy, Eric Cantor, and John Boehner came up with the leaders, the deputy whips, things like that, Michelle Bachmann's name was nowhere to be found.
I don't think basically they're interested in giving Michelle Bachmann the time of day. I think they think that she is ultimately a negative, that she pulls down the image.
But don't you want to keep her closer as a martyr rather than being a martyr?
Is she really a martyr, though? I mean, obviously the Tea Party people love her.
They do.
She can get on a lot of television programs. But if she goes out and runs for president, she has to make a case for herself as a presidential candidate. She can't run against the Republican leaders who spurned her back in Washington.
Well, how about this? If she doesn't have a future in the leadership of the House, she runs for the Senate against Amy Klobuchar.
I think that's probably the smarter race for her, but you know what? I think she loses that race. Because I think of all the endangered Democrats who were just first elected in 2006 and have to run for re-election to the Senate in 2012, Klobuchar is the most popular.
And plus the fact Minnesota is not known for electing right-wing Republican candidates. I mean, you think of Boschwitz and Durenberger and Norm Coleman.
All moderates. All moderates. They did elect
Rod Grams.
Rod Grams,
right.
But that perhaps was an unusual
and
circumstance.
It was a one-termer, right.
And he was a one-termer. I don't think Michelle Bachmann can beat Amy Klobuchar. Right. I think that would be a bad move for her, but I think it might be smart for her to take a Palin-esque route by becoming more of a media character even than she is today.
She is a media character.
And she would do that by going to Iowa a lot and to New Hampshire a lot. But there are a lot of other people who are mining, if you will, the Tea Party vein in Iowa and New Hampshire. You mentioned Rick Santorum, who lost by 17 points when he tried to get reelected to the Senate. And now thinks that there's a big outcry out there for him to be president. But then you've got Mike Pence, who also appeals to many on the Christian right. You have Mike Huckabee, who actually won Iowa in 2008, and that is certainly the greatest credential you could take into 2012.
Right, and the nominal frontrunner, we keep saying, I mean, who knows what a frontrunner is anymore. We decided 4 years ago that Hillary Clinton and Mitt Romney were the frontrunners, but I still think Mitt Romney goes into 2012 as the nominal front runner, whatever that means. Lindsey Graham, I thought it was interesting. Lindsey Graham gave an endorsement of Mitt Romney the other day. It wasn't the most full-throated endorsement I've ever heard in my life. He said he has problems, but they all have problems.
Yeah.
But if the Republican Party is going to be dominated by Tea Party-type thoughts in 2011, 2012, does Mitt Romney fit that bill? I mean, he's conservative. He's a business guy.
He passed Obamacare in Massachusetts and called it Massachusetts Care.
He's not a red meat kind of guy, and I think they're screaming for red meat right now.
That's right. But that's coming up against a very powerful tradition, a historic.
I know what you're going to say.
That Republicans tend to turn to an establishment figure for their presidential nominee.
And especially somebody who lost before.
That's right. Somebody who ran before and lost before. Bob Dole.
Nixon, Reagan, McCain.
That's right. And in Nixon's case in 1968, the timing was right. And it worked. In Bob Dole's case in 1996, I think a lot of people thought going into that campaign that it was going to work in a Nixon-like way,
yeah.
That Bill Clinton was very vulnerable, that he was going to go down, and they didn't foresee what 1996 politics were really going to be about, which was about Bill Clinton making this phenomenal recovery and doing battle initially with the Republican Congress and then compromising with them very strategically on welfare reform and a few other things. And he played it brilliantly. Dole didn't play it so well. He didn't excite people. He didn't cross over very
Plus
well.
Plus the fact that I think that both Dole in 96 and McCain in 2008 were past their prime when they were the nominees. I think Dole's high point was perhaps 88 when he ran against Vice President Bush, and perhaps McCain in 2000 when he ran against Bush's son.
Absolutely agreed. Yeah. Both of them would have been stronger candidates for president had they gotten those nominations. And look, I don't know that Mitt Romney is unnominatable. I certainly don't think he's unelectable. If the Republicans could give him their nomination in 2012, I still think he would be their strongest candidate against Barack Obama.
As long as we're talking about Republicans, coming up next week is the election for the RNC chairman. Very interesting debate this week. Michael Steele, who surprised me by even announcing that he was going to run for a second term.
Or by coming to the debate.
Exactly. And yet, I thought he did not badly. But the most interesting thing was that Reince Priebus, the nominal frontrunner, here we go, talking about frontrunners again.
He's the state party chairman of Wisconsin.
Who had a great year. They beat Russ Feingold.
Ooh,
they elected
fabulous.
Scott Walker governor. They won two House seats, picked up in front of the Democrats. But I watched him during the debate, and he said the most fascinating thing to me is he said, you cannot be pro-choice and be a Republican.
Yes,
now,
he did.
Now, I understand that nationally this is a pro-life party. Of course it is. It always has been. But to basically you're saying to Olympia Snow, to Susan Collins, to Republicans in Democratic-leaning states, you're pro-choice, forget about it. You're written off the party. And I thought that was a very telling and revealing moment for me. And having watched him say that, I kind of think that he's no longer, in my view, the odds-on favorite to become the next chair.
I absolutely agree with you. I thought that was a rather shocking moment. It is not the Reagan approach.
No.
It is not the Reagan philosophy.
Reagan would say, if you agree with me 80% of the time, that's fine with me.
Yeah, you're not my 20% enemy.
Right.
I think Ronald Reagan gave them a model for how to become the majority party, and they've struggled to follow it ever since they lost him. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Happy New Year, Ken.
You too, Ron.
And a happy podcast year.
You betcha.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Oh, it's crying time again. You're gonna need me. I can see that far away look in your eyes. I can tell by the way you hold me, darling, that it won't be long before it's crying time. Now they say that absence makes the heart grow fonder, and that tears are only